I may be talking too much.
No.
I haven't thought about these things for a long time. It's kind of fun.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing so now. You then moved into fabrics and finishes, 69 to 72. At this point, now you were general manager. You were no longer assistant general manager. Did you sense that you may have had some mentor or someone in the company working for your your case?
Not. My feeling was I had a great relationship with everybody around. I didn't really worry about one guy opposite the other. I did follow Norm Copeland a couple of steps up the road. He was a great blocker. I came to work for him as director of supporting research, process research in film from the plants, and he was then research director. He moved to assistant general manager. I moved to research director. Then he left that department, and I took his job again. So, in a sense, he was very helpful. But no, I never had a feeling that I had a white hat or anything like that. I just thought that I had lots of friends.
When you got to fabrics and finishes, that was the Corfam time.
Yes,
I recall. And
there sure was.
That was. One of the more infamous instances that in DuPont's history. Were you involved in shutting the business down?
Very definitely, along with John Metzger. It's a long, sad story, and everybody who was a player for a number of years has his own version of why. Mine's pretty simple. When we looked at the business and our competition, part of which was synthetic and part of which was not, there were a couple of things which I didn't see a way around. Number one, the price of leather had nothing to do with in effect, the cost of making leather products. That was a byproduct of the meat industry, and you know, the leather was whatever they could get for it, so that price was pretty spongy. And I guess I concluded that whatever it took to move the product, that would be the price that they offered, and so there wasn't much support in that direction. And leather did some things very, very well in the shoe industry, and so it was always going to be a player, but a pretty tough one from the economic perspective. With respect to the synthetics, we all sort of looked down our nose at vinyl coated fabrics and urethane coated fabrics until they worked. And when the market began to accept them, and people really threw all man-made products in the generic and just didn't make much difference to them. It looked good, they'd buy it. And then we looked at our mill costs, not just the current ones, but our projections of the best we could do. The exact numbers were, we concluded we could probably make Corfam as we then defined it for 40 or 50 cents a square foot. And vinyls were selling for 30. Now, there's a message there for somebody who has his eyes open. And the urethane products really weren't that bad. You know, they're pretty good. And in many applications. Corfam was a very good product, but a fairly expensive product. Among the sophisticated synthetics, it probably was the best. And that was borne out by the fact that the Poles looked at it very carefully and compared it with all the other offerings that were available at the time and decided they wanted the Corfam plant after we closed the business down. And they bought it lock, stock, and barrel, and as far as I know, it's still making product. So it wasn't that that we didn't make a good product or couldn't. Some of the earlier deficiencies we were well along to correcting, and we could see a day when we made a material that was every bit as comfortable as leather. Wore better, that has kept its good appearance longer and easier to care for. And could sell for a price that, could be recovered in the shoe business, which is a little bit different from saying it was competitive cost-wise with all the other things on the market. But it could have been a player. The problem was it could never be a really good earner. And a number of tens of millions of dollars would have had to be invested before it got to this comfortable level of performance. So, you know, it was a, when the air cleared, it was time to bag it. So Metzger made the, he and I and others talked about it for a long period of time and finally said, I really don't think we should continue this. And I agreed, and the committee agreed, so we cut it.
And shortly after that, you were made a vice president.
Yeah.
72.
73.
73. Okay.
Well, vice president in 72, they changed the titles. I didn't join the X committee until 73. Mm-hmm. They just changed the titles of the department heads, as I recall.
Did that come as a surprise to you, or were you expecting it at that
time? No, by that time, you look around and see who the players are, and again, I never took the position that there were not people in the system that were every bit as good as I was, but I also felt that I was as good as they were, so it was just how I was going to fall.
And the executive committee, of course, is really was in, runs the company. I mean, that's where the decisions are made. How many members were on it when you joined it?
8 or 9, as I recall. It goes up and down, but it was about that. 10 at the most, 8 at the least, I guess.
Again, I'm quoting, he distinguished himself as a team player who always shared the credit.
Why not? That's just being honest.
Okay. I think the more interesting thing to me was the fact that very shortly thereafter you picked up the research reins.
Yeah, I had that for a while. At that point, it was about half advisory and a little bit of direct managerial, but it was a fairly soft connection between the committee and the various units in the company. We did began to allocate assets at that point and encourage people to work in certain directions, but it was a while before it became a direct managerial responsibility.
Well, as I understand it, you very, very shortly there after 74, I guess, started indicating that the executive committee felt it necessary to reduce R&D within the company.
Yeah, our costs were pretty high. We've been through a decade. We launched a number of new ventures that didn't pan out particularly well. We really had demonstrated convincingly that the old formula, just identify a large market and figure out the way to supply it with a synthetic material, that alone was not enough to guarantee a successful business. And people would shoot me for using those crude words, but the new venture mania, which existed in the company in the 60s, had produced some businesses that were attractive, but it produced a large number of expensive failures. And we just concluded, you know, we got to rein this thing in a little bit. The company had been managed pretty much as a sum of its parts up until the mid-60s or even early 70s in some respects. Now we had to manage it so that it wasn't all top-down, but at least the parts weren't going to spend more of the resources than we had. It was going to be a plan that made sense for DuPont as a whole, as well as one that made sense for the individual departments. So it was no longer just managing the company as the sum of its parts. It was the DuPont company and these different departments and interests. And each year, we developed a business plan that made sense from the top down as well as the bottom up.
Having started out in your career out in research and in good basic science and basic chemistry, How did you feel about having to go to these people and say it's time that we make some change, serious changes here?
I didn't like it at all, but I didn't think it was wrong. I thought it was right. Well, the facts pretty much spoke for themselves. The record is what it was, and fact is we were in a situation where we were spending more for R&D than we could justify based on the results that we were getting from it. And that wasn't necessarily all research's fault, but here's a function that had simply gotten out of proportion with the rest of the business. And my message always was, hey fellas, if you want to spend more on research, there is one formula that will work every time. Let's make more money. And until we can do that, there isn't going to be more money for R&D. We simply have to live within our means until we can demonstrate the ability to bring on new things that will be very, very profitable and generate more discretionary cash. So it isn't rocket science. We had to do some resizing, make everything fit together.
The nylon, Teflon doesn't come along all that often.
No, they don't. In fact, polymer science has been a fascinating thing to watch. It's gone through several phases. In the 40s, 50s, well, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, we had these whole new families of important materials, and then there was a period of adapting them to all the use opportunities that existed. And then there was the period of combining them, composites and everything else. And so it's been reworked two or three times and still enormously important. And I suspect there's a lot of future to it too, but it's changing. Finding a new, simple combination of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen that's going to turn into a huge product is very difficult. One of the examples I used to use when I was talking about the Ponce Dilemma with new businesses, I said, well, nylon began, I guess at that time it would have been, let's see, this was about 1980 when I was making this comment, 40 years ago. The company was billion or $2 billion company, and nylon was a fledgling product. Today, nylon is a $2 billion business. So our challenge today with the pond at $40 billion is to come along with a new product that in 40 years will be $40 billion. Now you tell me what that is. that's the arithmetic of this rate of growth, and the simple truth is those products are not there. At least I don't think they are. They're very hard to find. Although there'll be new industries that'll be huge, and we're seeing some of that, but not necessarily based on polymers or even chemistry. It's not solely. So it's a dilemma. When you get older and bigger, and your product lines inevitably a bit more mature, you have to change a little bit of how you behave, and it's not just what's happened to you, it's what's happened to the rest of the world. In 1950, DuPont was unique in its ability to mount a major new venture. It had the technical ability, it had the business disciplines, it had the manufacturing capability, it had the engineering capability. There weren't many people like that in the world. By 1970, there was one, as I used to say, on every corner of every large city. Now, that's not quite right, but what I was trying to do was get people's attention on how much the outside world has changed, and therefore how unlikely it was that research per se was going to make us hugely successful. We had to do a lot of other things, and we had to recognize that the competitive picture had changed dramatically.
What kind of response did you get to this new, to this program?
I'd say generally favorable. In many respects, very favorable. One of my messages was, hey, don't look for the committee to save you. You're the guys that make the decisions day by day that really build this company, that change it. You're the agents of change. If you don't like what's going on around you, don't just look in the mirror every day. Don't look at the committee. It can't do everything for you. It's just not possible. And I made several speeches in which I said, if I look back at my career, I've made a lot of mistakes, but the mistakes that really bother me are the errors of omission, not commission. There were a lot of things that I could see and I should have done and I didn't do. And those are the ones that cause you not to sleep as well as you might otherwise. So there was a message for middle and upper management and everything I said that was very positive, that really said to these people, you're the ones with the clout. You're the ones that can make things happen. And none of us like our business performance over the last couple of decades. We all want to do better, and we can, but it's going to take input from every one of you. You're going to have to help us redefine DuPont and do those things that make it, again, what we think it should be in relation to our competitors. So I think we've been through that process, and no one of us did it all, or even most of it, but it's been a continuum since the late 60s, and Willard has certainly had his share of the problem, and he's handled it very courageously, and a very difficult challenge, but the results speak for themselves, and we are better.
Do you think that, well, go back to the time you joined the research group at DuPont, there was an attitude, maybe even a luxury of, we can do this great basic research. And DuPont had a long history of that, the papers and the literature and everything, that good solid chemistry going on. And maybe we'll get something good out of it, but was this really a luxury that you could no longer afford?
Well, I'm very reluctant to say that we can't afford it, that we shouldn't do some of it, but certainly it has to be done in proportion to its potential reward. And the fact is, the reward from that kind of goalless research is thin. We've had these arguments, not just in DuPont, but throughout the world and industry, whether research ought to be need-oriented or basic research with materials, and that the obvious uses will just fall out of that. Well, that's kind of a dumb argument. The fact is, it's an iterative process. Anything you can learn that's new and different and useful about the basic behavior of matter is fine. But it's not necessarily terribly rewarding just to start down that road. Certainly, anything that you can do to meet a very important need of the world in a cost-effective way is going to be very rewarding. So you can't get the need end out of it. You can't get the understanding of basic principles and behavior of matter and whatnot out of it. It's an iterative process. You got to do both. But we concluded, at least in the 70s and the 80s, we had to do a little bit less of this directionless research and a little bit more aimed at making our products better, our processes better. And where we could see new products, sure, go for it. Yeah. But be realistic about what competitors are doing and what the competitive response will be if you're going to try and knock somebody else off. Nobody gives up easily.
Well, I think the United States is probably in a unique position after World War II in terms of the strength of its chemical industry as opposed to the rest of the world.
Europe was in shambles. Our plants were together. We had going what they hoped to rebuild. The other side of that is 20 years later, they were working with new plants, and ours were aging, and they took advantage of all the new technology that came along. So, yeah, there's quite a dramatic change in 20 years.
You had an ad hoc committee at that time, which I believe consisted of several of the research directors, if not all of them.
Yes.
And then you reported to the executive committee. And there were several recommendations. One was to cut the R&D expense by 4% per year, or something like that. That central research was to give up one half of its budget from projects supported by the industrial departments.
The thought there was to try to impose a discipline on central research of of working on things that were important to existing businesses. And this was just a, kind of an arbitrary and not very sophisticated push to get them to do more work that the departments were enthusiastic about and could see some commercial value from. 50%, who knows what the right number is, but that's about where we thought we needed to get. And it was kind of a negotiated goal that everybody could live with, and I think it was very helpful. The 4% per year, I've never been terribly happy with the excesses that, that businesses had to go through in order to get its house in order. Sometimes they're just flat necessary. There's nothing else you can do. But I always been upset by recruiting years when we hired 2,000 and then the next year when we hired nobody or 100 or something like that. I said, you know, what kind of a message is that to send to the universities? That's terrible. Now, we're going to be in business forever, we hope. We know we're going to have ups and downs. Why do we ever hire 2,000? And why do we ever hire just 50? You know, why don't we be good enough managers so that we can, you know, well, we can't avoid the peaks and the valleys, but for heaven's sakes, let's smooth them out. Well, we eventually got some discipline in hiring, and we did get better. But to make a quick adjustment in an R&D program has incredibly negative morale implications and results, and I just haven't any stomach for that. With attrition, you can, as long as you're not bleeding to death, you can cure almost any problem. And I didn't think we were in bad enough shape so that we needed to do any more than a few percent per year, and normally that is done fairly easily.
Somewhere, I believe, Cairns came to you and said that the DuPont's research image had reached a low ebb in the universities.
Yeah, we got a lot of concern about that. And part of it was this cycling of recruiting. Part of it was the perception outside that we were really giving up on R&D, which was never true. We tried to deal with those impressions honestly and effectively, and I don't know how well we did, but I think eventually the universities recognized that we had no choice but to make some adjustments. And yes, we still love research, and we're going to do it, but it had to be the right size and generally pointed at the right goals. Otherwise, we couldn't afford it.
Well, certainly your alma mater, Illinois, and DuPont had a long-standing connection.
Wonderful.
And Carl Marble, as consultant to students.
An amazing man and a great friend.
Did you, just as an aside, did you ever pick up his love for birds along the way?
Well, he would not be very happy with what I do with birds. I think quail are marvelous eating. But yeah, I love nature very, very much. And even though I hunt and I fish, I am an ardent conservationist, belong to the Nature Conservancy Board and all the rest, but I don't do so much looking at them as he did.
I just talked to someone, I'm not sure if it was Jim Idle or not, I think it was Jim Idle, who said that Marvel told him if he ever had it to do over, he'd have been an ornithologist.
Marvel is that kind of person. He could do anything he wanted to, like Crawford Greenwald. Crawford was just incredible with the spectrum of interest that he had and his ability to do well in anything he chose to deal with. Marvel, the same kind of person.
By 1977, you were still assuring, as this program of change in R&D was going on, you were still assuring the board of directors, who evidently were getting nervous about things as well, that while the R&D was in a period of transition, you were still spending more than competitors in research. and that it was research was still critical to the company's future.
Board was, you know, a little uncomfortable about some of the things that were, I guess they were hearing on the outside. It's very hard to compare research programs because people don't use the same words to describe the same kinds of research. And our international people lump things somewhat differently. But as best we could measure it, we were doing about as much as anybody else, and maybe more. And there certainly was not a large gap. All of those discussions were less than truly scientific. You know, first place, nobody quite knew how to make the comparison. In the second place, whether we were doing the right amount has far more to do with what we were getting out of it than it does what anybody else does. So, you know, we tried to be comforting because we really thought DuPont was not going to fall behind. And the tuning up we were doing, in fact, might very well make us more productive and in the future justify even more. But there was a lot of nervousness, and those were words just to give people a little comfort. Which, you know, their discomfort was genuine, and we needed to deal with it. But I just never really worried that much about the intercompany comparisons.
Organic chemicals department suffered considerably at this time for a number of reasons. They had three major businesses, all of which ran into problems, beginning with dyes. I'm not sure when DuPont finally got out of dyes. Was that during your time?
Must have been around the mid-70s, somewhere in there.
And then, of course, CFCs and TEL, which were at one time three big players in the company.
That's right.
This sort of fits in with